And I'm gonna get started here. So I want to just welcome everybody for coming in on the call. Again, my name is Keith Harvey. I'm the regional director here at the American Friends Service Committee. We will be recording the call today so that friends and supporters who weren't able to make it tonight can hear the conversation, and it will be posted on our website in the next couple of days. So again, I want to just remind you, star 6 to mute yourself and star 7 to unmute to ask question. I'll keep saying this throughout the, you know, throughout the time together. We hope to be together for about an hour, you know, or as long as we need to be. And so if we don't need the full hour, that's cool. It's sort of an open conversation there. So I want to... Okay, so we're going to mute everybody now.
Okay.
The conference has been muted.
And then now that we're all unmuted, I want to introduce Joe Gerson. Joe Gerson is our director of programs here in the Cambridge office. He directs seven and supervises seven programs around the region. And Joe is with us to be talking about just the changing what's going on with the U.S. and its changing role as its its global powers being reduced and some of the consequences that come with that. So I'm just going to let Joe kind of jump in. And Joe, if you can begin, say hello to everybody. Is Joe there? Joe? We need to unmute him.
Hello?
There it is, Joe.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry. We had you muted.
So just to say that it would be, you know, ideal if I could at least see everybody's eyes and preferably your face and speak to you more directly. But I'll try to work through an outline and hopefully keep it interesting for you, and then move to more direct questions. You know, my sense is that any number of us could identify a whole host of changes going on in the world that affect us, you know, from climate change and China's rise to the question of, you know, is Europe over, which is kind of dominating the press right now, Arab Spring, the list goes on. What I thought I would do would be to kind of focus on three, kind of the relative decline of the United States, its pivot toward Asia and NATO as a global alliance, and then just maybe say a few things about some of the program work we're doing in relationship to that. Let me start with the relative decline. I think we need to understand that what's happening is basically structural, the unemployment that unemployment numbers that we have with the recession are not only high, but unlike previous recessions, the jobs aren't going to come back because most of them have been exported to other countries. And to understand that there's other dimensions to, it's not like a one-time job loss because the technology is exported and it's at the point of production that most innovation takes place. So we have some fairly deep structural problems that are complicated by the ostensible ideology of free trade, the assault on efforts to have regulation and not to have any industrial policy. So that sets us all behind. There's an article in the current issue of Foreign Affairs, and I think it's really quite remarkable that Foreign Affairs has an article titled Inequality and American Decline by George Packer. And again, he sees this in a somewhat longer term. It begins with basically a quotation from a worker saying we're just not that good anymore. And just let me read a couple of the quotes from it. He says, Iraq was a kind of stress test applied to the American body politic, and every major system and organ failed the test. The executive and legislative branches, the military, the intelligence world, for-profits and non-profits, the media. And talks about a growing arteriosclerosis of American institutions, and points to basically says that we have some cultural problems here, including the inability to think beyond the short term. And he goes on, you know, at some length. I'd commend that article to people. He points to 1978 as the time when this crystallized. Looking at on the one hand the stagflation of that period, you'll remember some of the issues around Jimmy Carter, as well as the fear in elite circles kind of growing out of the social movements of the 60s. And what he argues is that the business community, the elite business community at that point ceased thinking about what was generally in the common interest, and moved to, from their perception, to defend capitalism by creating things like the American Enterprise Institute, Heritage Foundation, increasing the number of lobbyists in Washington from like 145 companies having them to over 2,000, and the emergence of greater economic inequality, and the lack of thought about what's really in the national interest. Another way to look at this, as I've been thinking about it lately, goes pretty back deep into the culture. Just checking my Supreme Court decisions earlier today, there was a famous case, the Dartmouth College versus Woodward case in 1819, which recognized corporations as having the rights of natural persons. And then, you know, the more recent, in the 1930s, decision interpreted by the current Supreme Court as saying that corporations have the same rights as individuals for the 14th Amendment. So we move into the environment which our, you know, our politicians are spending all of their time seeking money for their expensive campaigns and become indebted into the you know, to the corporate world rather than pursuing the interests of the U.S. people. At a military, and we have, you know, we've got the issues of the tax structure, the loss of the Glass-Steagall Act, and so on and so forth. At the military level, the United States is relatively weaker than it's been in the past, in part because of overextension, the wars that it's been fighting, the emergence of what's called asymmetrical warfare, you see from 9/11, or cyber warfare. I was at a talk by a guy from NATO the other day, and about all he could talk about was cyber warfare and whether we should be developing offensive as well as defensive capabilities. If you look at the Stuxnet virus that was launched against the Iranians, it appears we already do have an offensive capability. You also have a relative loss of technological advantage against other countries. So China, for example, right now is competing with the United States in the militarization of space. It's building more intercontinental ballistic missiles. It's building missiles that can destroy aircraft carriers, and it's moving to have a Blue Sea Navy. And then, of course, you know, the focus on Iran, North Korea, kind of reflect the fears around nuclear weapons proliferation. And then we have a diplomatic set of losses and setbacks in terms of U.S. power and respect of the United States. And the reality is we had the 8 years of Bush. And those, you know, when you have a wound, it takes, and we still are overcoming that. Much of the world, I think, has lost a lot of faith in President Obama, who makes speeches like the Cairo speech, but then fails to follow through for the Palestinians. You know, we've lost some considerable influence, not necessarily influence that was good, with the Arab Spring. Meanwhile, backing the Saudis as they send in troops to occupy Bahrain. So in terms of kind of meta power at a number of levels, U.S. power in the world is reduced. So then the question comes, how is the U.S. elite seeking to compensate for this? And the two areas that I want to focus on have to do with the pivot toward Asia and NATO. Try to find a piece of paper and go with a couple of quotes here. You know, I'm just actually back from the APEC conference in Hawaii, and we did a conference about 3 weeks ago in Washington on peace in Asia and the Pacific. Shortly before we had our conference in Washington, Hillary Clinton came out with a major article in Foreign Policy magazine. It's sort of setting out markers not only for the international community, but for U.S. Congress, for the entire system here in the United States, basically saying that as the United States withdraws from Iraq and winds down its war in Afghanistan, we have to pivot toward Asia. And let me just quote a little bit from the first paragraph of her article, which is titled America's Pacific Century. As the war in Iraq winds down and America begins to withdraw its forces from Afghanistan, the United States stands on a pivot point. One of the most important tasks over the next decade will be to lock in a substantially increased investment, diplomatic, economic, strategic, and otherwise, in the Asia-Pacific region. So this is where the focus is. Next question a little bit is in terms of the why. One of the people, I'm here in Cambridge, and one of the advantages of being in Cambridge is you can wander down about a mile from our office and sit on some seminars at Harvard, and you have the kind of rotating power elite through there, one of whom is a guy named Joe Nye, who was Deputy Secretary of Defense in the Clinton administration. He's one of the principal authors of U.S. Asia policy over the last 20 years. And he wrote recently, and I quote, "Asia will return to its historic status with more than half of the world's population and half of the world's economic output. America must be present there." This is the amazing part here. He says, "Markets and economic power rest on political frameworks, and American military power provides that framework." So the United States is looking to compensate for its relative disadvantages through increasing its military influence and power in the Asia-Pacific region, principally to engage China, to integrate into the global system on U.S. terms and conditions, and to contain it to ensure that that happens. I'll say a little more about that in a moment. Could go on a bit more, but I'll leave. One other piece.
Yeah, Joe, I want you to talk a little bit about how your work has been doing some work around some of these issues.
Okay, sure. Yeah. So on this, I mean, we've been doing work on Asia Pacific now for over 25 years, working closely with Japanese peace movements. Out of that grew some connections with some people in China, working with people in the islands. A lot of that work is around trying to build understanding here, which of what's happening in the region, or perspectives of these countries, which is what we did with our Asia Pacific conference. And a good part of it is also building solidarity with movements and doing solidarity actions with people, whether it's in Okinawa, who are opposing the continued presence of the U.S. bases there, Jeju Island, where they're building a new base, and so on. So that's a major focus of what we've been doing. Coming back to my outline here for half a second. I think the other piece where we're looking to integrate a lot of our work is looking at the economic dimensions. So among the things that we're looking at here are the bases and growing military alliances. The United States is, President Obama is just in Australia today, looking to bring Marines in there to reinforce the U.S. presence there. We're trying to help people understand what's happening through the region. One of the things that's not been on, we're trying to raise things that haven't been on people's agenda. So again, one of the central elements in the APEC conference in Hawaii was a thing called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, where the United States is trying to kind of build a super NAFTA through much of Asia Pacific that would either exclude China or force China to change some of its laws so that the United States has greater access to its economy. One element that was interesting in the conference we had in the run-up to it, I got caught rather intensely between the Vietnamese and Chinese, actually their governments, over the issue of the South China Sea, which is not on many agendas here in the United States, but it's where there's major military buildups by the United States and other countries. Let me just help put it on your agenda by saying that under the South China Sea, which is claimed, 80% of it's claimed by China, but other countries like Vietnam, the Philippines, Brunei, Indonesia also have claims to the same area. And under there, you've got massive amounts of oil and natural gas under the seabed, plus minerals. You've had a number of military confrontations. The Chinese have said that this is a core interest to ensure their control over it. The United States responded by saying, no, this is a core interest of the United States. And we now have a major U.S.-Chinese confrontation over that. The issues in Northeast Asia continue. And with the help of Xi Mian, who is just a fabulous speaker we've had at a number of our conferences, we've also been looking at how India relates to all this, and we can go into that in discussion. I just jumped off of a conference call of the NATO Free World Network that we helped to create. Kind of growing out of, we think of the Afghanistan war as a U.S. war, but in Europe it's understood as a U.S.-NATO war, and, European countries have been deeply involved in it. Just as the United States is pushing Japan and Korea to take on greater regional and global responsibility to compensate for some of those deficits that I talked about in the beginning, the United States has been working to transform NATO. They have now what's called a new strategic concept, basically a new doctrine. And the key elements of it are that the focus of NATO is no longer the defense of Europe, but what they call out-of-area operations. And we saw this most recently in the war in Libya. And the other element is to expect an increased role for Europeans in the war fighting and military preparations. And, again, we saw that with Britain and France in the Libya war. So what we're doing here is that I've been to the last couple of kind of counter-conferences during the last two NATO summits in Strasbourg and in Lisbon. And in Lisbon, it was announced that the next NATO summit was going to be in the United States, and people looked at me to begin the organizing for that. Since then, Rahm Emanuel moved to Chicago and is bringing both the G8 conference and the G8 summit and the NATO summit to Chicago in May. And we have quite a range of organizations now who are working to both organize a national speaking tour, to build a counter-summit conference in Chicago at the time, and to be building movements around this that engage with the economics. I mean, to appreciate that while we're working to move the money from military spending to meeting human needs, the Pentagon is saying we're going to have absolutely no cuts, in fact, likely an increase in U.S. military power in Asia and the Pacific, and we're going to continue building out NATO. So we want people to understand what's driving it, as well as to give them handles for working to cut the Pentagon budget. Maybe then just the last thing I'll say as I move to wrap up here is to say something about our Wage Peace campaign, which is part of a national campaign by AFSC to reduce Pentagon spending and to meet human needs. A number of you on this call, I expect, receive our action alerts, so you've gotten those appeals from us to call Congress to press them to vote for this this amendment or that one, or not to permit cuts here or there. One of the things that we're turning to is a resolution campaign, which I want to highlight. We want to, the Occupy movement has helped to crystallize understanding of what's termed the 99% and the 1%. But we understand that we need to, if you will, move beyond the Occupy movement not to undermine it. But that more than encampments are necessary, that we need to engage the United Church of Christ in this community, or the Quaker meeting in that community, or the Nurses Union in another community, to be engaging in these discussions more deeply, and to be considering how they can communicate with their congressional representatives, maybe their city council, to press them to work for cutting Pentagon budget, so that we can have the schools and the medical care and the 21st economy that we need. So we have a kind of a resolution template that in the coming months we'll be taking to a number of organizations, and would love it if people on this call would be in touch with us afterwards to see how we might either send them a copy of that resolution, possibly have an AFSC speaker come and meet with your group and see how we can work together to do that. So I'll kind of wrap it up there as a quick, you know, very quick and dirty overview. I'm sorry if I spoke too fast, and try to take people's questions in a more slow and relaxed manner.
Okay, so I want to open it up for questions and comments. So again, it's star 7 to unmute, and just throw out your thoughts and what you think, and we can have a conversation here. So please feel free to open up with a question if you have one. Joe, I want to real quick. I know you have been traveling around. Well, I just want to let everybody know Joe's been traveling around the world. It seems like talking in China and stuff. And so I know you just got finished your conference. Just wanted you to just. Was there any other interesting things that came out of that conference that you might want to say?
Well, it was really quite an interesting conference, and I have to say I'm fortunate that at this point in my life, a number of organizations are willing to pay for me to come to these conferences, so I don't do it primarily on AFSC's ticket. This conference was pretty unique in that it was organized by three somewhat different forces. There's an organization called the International Globalization Forum, based out of California, the Department of Hawaiian Studies at the University of Hawaii, and a network principally of Native Hawaiian sovereignty activists. So you have some very different perspectives coming in. And they organized a conference that would initially kind of highlight indigenous cultures, basically from Hawaii to New Zealand. And in a sense, their view of what economies and social economies should look like, you know, very much in counter distinction to AIPAC. I mean, it's very interesting to hear people say, look, you know, basic values that AFSC and Quakers and I'm sure many people on this call hold, that, you know, the money economy is there, but what is real wealth, you know, is having family, having a sustainable environment, and caring for you know, one's religious and cultural traditions.
I think we have okay. If you have a question, I think somebody may have a question.
I have a question.
Yeah. Okay. What's your name?
If it's me, my name is Carol Erner.
Yep, Carol, that's you. Okay, go ahead.
And I was very excited about the Pacific Peace and the Pacific Conference. And I'm also looking forward to the one on NATO. But I wonder, Joe, if you could tell us a little bit about things that people may not know about who was at the conference and in terms of nationalities and presenters and what, yeah, well, you know what I want.
Sure. We have, actually, just to say, we have a report that needs to have one more bureaucratic green light before we can post it, but we'll have it out. I think we had people from 7 or 8 different countries at the conference in Washington. Growing out of our effort to help people in the United States have a better understanding of Chinese perspectives, even if we don't necessarily agree with them, we had 20 people from China, including a woman who is the vice president of the Standing Committee of the People's Congress, which made life quite interesting having somebody of that high rank, plus a number of Chinese scholars, some of whom were really quite impressive. We had it's interesting. We worked with a couple of Korean American organizations, and kind of growing out of our work with them, we had maybe about 4 people from Korea who were largely focused on seeking support and solidarity to prevent the building of this new base at a place called Jeju Island, a place which is, I think has 7 UNESCO World Heritage Sites, but which is basically having these reefs and much of the island destroyed to build a Navy base for containment of China. We had from Japan both the former head of the Japan Council Against A&H Bombs, someone I've worked with over many years, who focused his remarks both on their campaigning for nuclear weapons abolition and seeking, you know, more people to join them, as well as looking at the centrality of the U.S.-Japan alliance, and, you know, looking at the basic contradictions in Japan, where they have non-nuclear principles and say that the government has non-nuclear principles and is supposed to be working for nuclear weapons abolition, but has its basic military policy rooted in the U.S. nuclear umbrella. We had people from Vietnam who were in large measure expressing some of their concerns about China's growing power, and both from Vietnam and the Philippines, it was interesting. You had the old analogy of when, you know, about ants, that when elephants are either battling or making love, it can be rather painful for ants, and fears that on the one hand they might get caught up in a U.S.-Chinese conflict, or on the other hand that when the United States and China move together that their interests could be neglected. I will say that we had somebody from Hawaii, which may not sound like a foreign nation to most people on the call here, but to appreciate that the native Hawaiian people, many of them have yet to recognize the United States' national sovereignty. They view their country and their government as having been overthrown in an illegal coup, and watching their culture be destroyed. And a man named Ikeka Hussey just gave an absolutely fantastic talk in which he described how within his family, you know, they maintain traditions, values, how he teaches his children. It was really quite a compelling talk. And we had others from, from as far away as New Zealand. So that was quite good. I guess one thing
I want to give some time to see if other people have other questions. So if you can close, I mean, if you have something.
I can close there. That's fine.
Okay. Just want to remind folks, it's *7. So if you *7, you can unmute yourself and ask a question. I just want to give an opportunity for folks to ask a question.
Hello, Joe.
Mm-hmm.
This is Steve McNagg calling from Wellesley Friends Meeting.
Hi, Steve. I owe you a call.
Oh, you do. That's right. But in any case, I listened with great interest to what you have to say. You know, I'm just sitting here riveted with the idea of looking at possibilities of hostilities with Iran.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're talking about the sort of the Pacific idea, but I'm not sure we're finished in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
What is your thought about that? I mean, there certainly is a huge effort among the neoconservatives to create this war. Suggestions, we hear suggestions sort of weekly that the Israelis may not even tell us if they start to attack Iran. What is your sense about that? I mean,
just to agree, the United States clearly is not finished in the Middle East, in significant measure because of oil, but not only because of oil. And Frank Petraeus today is, you know, I guess saying in terms of Iraq, you know, look, even if we withdraw from Iraq, we still have 40,000 troops there. You know, my sense is that, and I may take some flack for this, but my sense is that the Israeli government of recent years is to say that it's out of control would be an understatement. Between, you know, just the extreme right wing of the party and of Foreign Minister Lieberman, not to mention Netanyahu, and you know, you have these forces that have, I mean, just basically like the tail wagging the dog in terms of U.S. policy. So it's what it does to the Palestinians is just, you know, atrocious. In that context, you know, we have Iran, and my sense is that at one level, the United States ultimately may not be be able to prevent Israel from attacking. And were that to happen, clearly Iran and a number of other countries will assume that the United States gave Israel a green light, and we'll have a lot to pay for that. That said, you'll recall that Netanyahu wanted to attack Israel earlier, a few years ago, when Bush
wanted to attack Iran earlier.
I'm sorry, wanted to attack Iran, mm-hmm. and President Bush actually said no. And at the moment, the U.S. military is pressing really quite hard on Israel not to attack. Now, Israel may not obey that, but I think the perception is that if Israel does attack, Iraq will get rather more interesting, to say the least. Hamas will go, Hezbollah will go, we'll have a whole lot more terrorist attacks. I think there's a perception that it's just not in even in big geostrategic interest for the United States to allow such to happen. And you do have thinking going on in a number of circles about how the United States would, if you will, coexist with a small Iraqi nuclear weapon. I think the perception largely is that Iran probably won't develop a nuclear weapon as such, but will move to becoming a near nuclear power. And this has certainly consistently augmented Iran's influence as it's moved in this direction. Once Iran crosses that line, what you're going to find is much greater nuclear weapons proliferation through the Arab world, which actually undermines Iranian power and influence. So, mm-hmm. So in many ways, Iran may be, if you will, following the Japanese model of becoming a near nuclear power. But that doesn't mean that countries like Israel or the United States won't do something stupid.
Well, it seems to me that our anybody left, any troops left in Iraq are essentially hostages to that situation, are they? I mean,
of course. It's not only troops in Iraq who are hostage, but, you know, it doesn't take too much to blow up the U.S. embassy again in Beirut, to hit a McDonald's in Bahrain. The security is very soft. And in the end, I mean, peace and security depends on having decent relations with other people.
Thank you.
I know I haven't answered your fears, and I'm not sure it's possible to do that in the end.
Hmm.
I mean, I guess just the other piece that I haven't hit, and just to say, and I've done a number of interviews with Iranian radio, and you know what they consistently hit at is the double standard that it's okay for the United States to possess, modernize, and threaten use of its nuclear weapons, but they can't. And so,
Israel with 200 nuclear weapons, right?
Oh, 2 to 4, whoever knows what that number is.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of turning the environment, working to build down those arsenals is the way that one can, I think, create real security. That requires some courage on the part of some members of Congress. And we haven't, that's where we have to kind of keep asking those hard questions to members of Congress. And to candidates.
Our Congress is hopeless. I mean, I just can't believe, that they will pass measures to essentially immunize Israel from everything they've done and everything they will do.
So far, you're right. So far, you're right.
Do we have other questions? Anybody else wants to add
in? Yes.
Yep.
Hi. I'm Dave Wilson. Do I have the...
Yes, Dave, you jumped in, so go ahead.
Oh, good. I'm an engineer from MIT, and I haven't been able to hear the train of the discussion up to now entirely, so I apologize if I'm changing the topic a little bit. But I did hear, Joe, I think it was, discussing a paper in Foreign Affairs, which I obviously mm-hmm. need to read, about the influence of inequality on the country.
Mm-hmm.
And among other things, you mentioned that in 1978, or the author said, in 1978, that was the point at which everything changed, and the number of lobbyists went up by 10 or something like that. I remember being an engineer in 78. It was very exciting because the energy crisis, so-called, that
mm-hmm.
led to the formation of a huge number of firms that were solving all kinds of problems. And then either 79 or 1980, the oil price collapsed and most of these companies went bust. What has fascinated me also is that I came in 61 to join a company over here, and I became a citizen in 71, and I testified five times before Congress, and I look back in my correspondence and I see that all kinds of big shots like Senator Proxmire and other people would answer my letters. In the last 20 years, I've hardly got any answer to any letter I send to anybody, even though President Obama says, bring your ideas to me, we want to consider everything. I've written to every aide he has without getting even a postcard in response. So there are several things that seem to come from this, and one of them is, what are we all doing talking about things when we can't influence government in any way whatsoever? Or can we? I thought that the Occupy Washington displays were one way of doing it. And recently, Warren Buffett, I don't know whether you've all received a message from him saying that we could solve the problems of the country immediately by passing a law that said that if the deficit got more than 3% of something or other, I think it was GDP, then every member of Congress would not be able to stand for Congress again, and we'd have a new bunch that would solve things. So I guess that's it's a rather mixed bag that I'm bringing out, but I'd love to hear people's conversation about that.
Well, just a couple of pieces. There's a fine book called I'm blanking on the title of it at the moment, by a guy who teaches at Catholic University. It's called Dark Ages America. And one of the things he does in there is to look at Jimmy Carter's speech, I think it was, 79 or 78 or 79, where he was talking about limits and the response to that, that the U.S. people didn't want to accept that there were limits. Remember that under Carter, we had legislation that, for example, gave tax breaks for people who wanted to go solar with their homes. There were a number of pieces of legislation and regulations to help us move toward greater sustainability, and it was when Reagan came in that they were all wiped out, and we've been suffering since. In terms of what you're saying about the inability to communicate with members of Congress and for them to be responsive, as I was saying earlier, both the economic changes where you've got big business with all of its money, so much of its money going both to lobbyists, and now with Citizens United, basically have a free pass to give as much as they want to buy candidates, which in turn moves people in the political system, to be looking rather more to who's going to give them money than who's going to be asking them questions. It was interesting when the Chinese were here for our conference, we took them to see Occupy Washington, and I have to say they weren't too terribly impressed. And one of them asked me, well, what can that accomplish? And I said to him, well, I mean, I think they've changed the discourse in this country. I mean, we're now talking about the 1% and the 99%. We're talking about an unresponsive political system. And clearly that has helped to move things. I think there are other ways that we can, from time to time, kind of press the system to get it to work for us. But it takes imagination. I mean, our staff person up in New Hampshire, Arnie Alpert, has done fantastic training in terms of what's called bird dogging. The candidates do have to come out from time to time. And when they come out, we have to be there, and we have to be there in some sort of force to show them which way we need to go, and using good questions when the media is present to educate the wider community. At one level, one can feel hopeless, and on the other hand, the election results from a week or so ago indicate that you know, our worst fears of where the U.S. political system may be going, you know, may not come to pass.
Another question. Star 7 to unmute. So just reminding folks, star 7 unmute and jump in.
I have a question.
Yes, go ahead.
My name is Nancy Rice.
Hi, Nancy.
Hello,
hi.
Nancy.
I have a question, and it has to do with the underlying foundation of the war on terror, which contributes to a lot of our problems, including these so-called wars, in my view. It's been touted as the foundation for the war on terror, yet there are many, many questions around that event. And over 1,600 engineers and architects have stated that those three buildings that exploded that day could not possibly have fallen in that way. So they're asking for a new real investigation. And yet this is a topic that's pointedly ignored by, well, most all of the media and most all of the left. And I just wondered, it seems as though peace groups like AFSC would do well to take another look at that and see if they can agree that this needs looking into, because as time goes on, more and more people around the world are realizing that this is a false assumption about what happened, and to me, it's an important thing to expose so that there. I think it could help us to the way of peace if the U.S. would look into this and care about it, the people of the U.S. Could you comment on that, please?
Sure. Yeah, Nancy. You know, I'm not an engineer, and I know there are lots of debates around this. And my sense has been that rather than to be caught up in an area where I really don't have expertise, and most people don't, that what we do know is that there are a number of policy decisions, some related to that, some preceding it, you know, which are ignominious and not in people's interests. You know, we can certainly do well to, and one can be a little bit surprised that we didn't deal with Cheney and torture, that we haven't looked at a number of our really gross human rights violations, which, if they were addressed, might really affect the political culture here. You know, I think clearly where I think change has to take place, you know, where if you will, most people are living, and most people at this point are living with economic insecurity, and in an environment where a number of the answers for the way forward are pretty clear: cutting the military budget, changing the tax structure, and were we to do those things, that would change our foreign policy. It would make it possible for us to pay for our kids to have education. So I think we do better to focus where people are living, and where it's where we have a degree of expertise that others can recognize. I think AFSC is not known for its engineering skills.
Well, I just say that you don't have to be an engineer to see how Building 7 fell down, and so. I can see what you're saying about trying to address where people are thinking right now, but I just think that to ignore such an important event as that is counterproductive to working for peace in one way. And I do admire and appreciate your work, so I'll just end with that. Thank you.
Okay, and Nancy, just to appreciate the good work that you did in terms of trying to make the election process a bit fair that in the end got overruled. But you did really fine work, and I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Hello, can I be heard?
Absolutely, go ahead.
This is Mike Brower from Cambridge, Joe. I've got three topics I'll just throw out, one of which at least you've already addressed partly. Cutting the military budget. I heard Congressman Barney Frank from Newton speak the other day. He's one of the few courageous congressmen who've been outspoken about that. And I'd like to hear your comments. I know you're for that. Mm-hmm. And how we can promote that around the country to get congressmen to wake up. Secondly, our drone attacks. For those of you who don't know, or maybe everybody does, a drone is an unmanned U.S. aircraft which bombs on some suspicion, many times killing innocent women and children in Pakistan or Afghanistan. And the third is public financing of elections. Is there any hope? Do you have any views about that? Are there any countries that we could copy?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so three big questions. Let me begin with a mutual appreciation of Barney Frank. And we do have in Eastern Massachusetts a 25% campaign, which has been trying to hold both Barney and members of the congressional delegation here to, you know, to be voting consistent with that commitment. And one of the things that one of the openings that we have is that Barney has called for the reduction of foreign military bases. Actually, the bipartisan Commission on Deficit Reduction has called for cutting U.S. foreign military bases by a third. And as AFSC is doing its work on the military budget, we're focusing to a significant degree both on that and on nuclear weapons, where Obama committed to increase spending by $200 billion for nuclear weapons over the next decade, and $185 billion. And so we're working on that. And I can put you in touch. This is a kind of a statewide network we've created called Fund Our Communities, Not War, which is also looking at the possibility of doing a statewide referendum next year. It's a big piece to bite off, so we're kind of approaching it in exploratory mode. In terms of drones, you know, there are a number of people and some movements that are kind of focusing in on the drone attacks exclusively, and more power to them. I think what we've been trying to focus on are sort of the policies behind it. And I need to tell a story because it's so mind-boggling. I went over to Harvard a couple weeks ago because of the NATO work I'm doing, and they had the number two-star general from the United States who's responsible for working on the transformation of NATO speaking. And he went through, you know, he gave his you know, probably his $75,000 PowerPoint advertising program, talking about the various opportunities and challenges we face, from cyber warfare to climate change to drug dealing. And I asked him, when he got through with it, I asked him when they were doing their threat analysis if they had given any consideration to the way our neocolonial wars in Afghanistan and in Iraq may have further alienated people who still look at the West through the eyes of the Crusades and European colonialism. And it was like a deer caught in the headlights. It was like this idea had never occurred to him. He ran away from it, began talking immediately about cyber warfare. And it does reflect, you know, if you will, just what a different kind of worldview that some of these people are working out of. But I think we need to deal, I think where we have the principal openings, I mean, I think we need to illuminate a lot of the crimes and the blowback that come from drones. But I think we can engage more people in broader movements by focusing on the military spending and the dangers of the broader wars that we're pursuing. In terms of public financing, this is an area that is not my area of expertise. I think there are a number of models, and Nancy Rice, who was had asked that question before, did some very good work in Vermont, actually getting a state law passed that basically leveled the playing field. And then the courts came in with their bias and looked back to the role of corporations in all of this, and they took it away. I think one of the things that we need to deal with is at a cultural level, you know, where in many ways, you know, the U.S. people have become consumers before becoming citizens. I think one of the hopeful things about the Occupy movement is it reminds us that we're citizens. And we really can't win those kind of changes unless we build popular movement. I mean, members of Congress are not going to vote laws that are going to move them out of Congress. So we have to kind of create the environment that, that makes those changes.
Joseph, I'm sorry, what was the question you asked that was so difficult for us to avoid?
My question was, do our wars in Afghanistan and Iraq create more insecurity for us than help? I mean, do they create enemies and people who want to attack the United States? Duh.
Yeah.
And this had never been in his frame of reference. I mean, he was just, like, amazed.
To follow up on drones, this is simply a factual question. You know, I've assumed that drones are actually fairly easy to shoot down. Fairly easy to shoot down. I mean, that they're slow. So it seems to me that the fact that there are drones operating in Pakistan, if I were in that northern area of Pakistan, I would be furious at my Air Force for allowing this to go on. Same thing happens in Yemen as well. I think that the operation of drones, and this is, I mean, I was not happy about Anwar al-Awlaki's death, and his son's death 2 weeks later was just horrifying. Mm-hmm. Also a drone kill, 16-year-old. But the people in those countries, we're depending on the fact that they do not, have decided not to defend their own citizens. Is this correct, or am I under?
I think there's probably across a bit of a spectrum, because in Pakistan, the question is, do you have a unified government there? Do you have a unified military? And that's not entirely clear. I'm not in a position to be able to talk about the technical ability to shoot these down in terms of how visible they are. And one of the unfortunate things, there was a recent article where they're talking about miniaturization of these drones. Now, the smaller they get, obviously, the less payload they can carry.
Mm-hmm.
But they're looking to make drones about the size of bugs and birds.
Dragonflies, yeah.
So the deeper problem here is the assumption that we somehow have the right to control, or that we have the answers for these societies. And we do better. I think we need to send the message that, look, I mean, if you go to China, you see given all of China's problems, nonetheless, you see what a leadership that has vision can do in terms of mobilizing its economic resources, in terms of lifting more than 300 people out of poverty in a 30-year period of time, building mass transit.
Yeah.
I mean, Germany is the one country in the West which has come through the economic crisis thus far quite well. One of the basic resources they have is an educated populace. In Germany, education is free, as high as your qualification will take you, even to a PhD. Here, we're in a situation where higher education is it's increasingly difficult for people to get it just because of the money. We're laying off teachers. We're closing libraries. My wife is a teacher, and she sees her students less capable now than they were 10 years ago.
Let me interrupt. Correct yourself on how many people the Chinese have lifted out of poverty.
Joe, you said 300.
I'm sorry, 300 million.
300 million.
Right? Thank you.
300 million. I'm sorry.
We're getting close to the end of an hour, so I want to open it for one more question if we have. Do we have another question in the conversation? And I didn't mean to cut you off, Joe. You can.
No. 300. The answer was direct, which is not to say that there aren't 200 million migrant workers who don't have a lot of rights. I mean, there's a lot of problems there.
Mm-hmm.
But the society is really in growth. That's become it's the motor engine for the global economy.
Okay. Hello.
Yep. Yeah. Go ahead.
Sandy Isaacs here. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Sandy.
Did I misunderstand you? But did you say you were assuming that the U.S. in the future major powers would come from our military power?
Well, what I'm saying is that they're trying to compensate for the loss of economic power and people decline of respect for the United States by augmenting our military power in Asia Pacific.
And does that mean that you assume that the American voter isn't about to change and that we're going to keep supporting the military like this?
Well, I think what we're hearing from Panetta and others is that even if the military budget is significantly decreased, say through the super committee or otherwise, that the cuts are not going to come in Asia Pacific. That in fact they may, even with cuts in the Pentagon budget, they may augment U.S. military power in Asia and the Pacific. In many ways, this is, if you will, parallel to what happened in the 1890s when the United States sought the China market and conquered a number of countries to get to it. And this is the direction they're going. They're really quite clear. You should take a look at Hillary's article in Foreign Policy. I'll be happy to. I think we have a link to it on our webpage.
Okay, I'll check it. Thank you.
Let's go one more question. If anybody has one lingering question before we close for the evening, anybody else? *7 is how you unmute.
Well, let me then just make one last appeal.
Okay.
For people to consider taking our resolution template, which I'm happy to send to you, to your Peace and Social Concerns Committee, to your teachers union, to your student group, whatever it is, so we can kind of help move this discussion a little bit deeper. Because we need, as much as we appreciate what the Occupy movement has done to the national discourse, we need to take it deeper structurally into the society.
Joe, give them your email address.
My email address is jgerson, at afsc.org.
Really interested. This is Elizabeth. We're trying to do so many teach-ins. And you've been talking for, 35 or 40 minutes, and you don't often have that long when you're, when you're having a group of people that you want to give them some ideas about what they can do, where they are, without a PhD in whatever you've got PhDs in. What's the most effective way of reaching people?
Well, there's not one most effective way. I mean, there's this gazillion of them. As we're into the world of electronic communication with Facebook and the web. I mean, you've got at least 35 or 50 people you know well, right? And sharing articles that you think are interesting with them or action alerts, that's a community of people that you can begin to move. Having once every 6 months a bit of a house party to bring people together and talk about an issue that's important to you. Working within institutions like religious congregations, where people are there in many ways to be discussing values as well as religious, the more spiritual beliefs. Right? They're obviously related.
We have been through, all of that lightly. And one of the things that we're focusing on right now is how to make sure that our government is going to get out of Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, we really will have a hard time going any place until we stop pouring millions of dollars into both of those countries.
Right.
And even now, it seems very questionable that that's going to happen.
Yeah, I think they'll come out of Iraq, but Afghanistan, they're talking about permanent bases.
Yeah.
They're talking about permanent bases, and I think part of it is whenever. You watch where your members of Congress are going to be. and pursue them.
Yeah.
Use the letters to the editor page. I mean, there's a whole range of things that we can do.
Great.
This is Mike Brower intervening. I don't agree that we're going to come out of Iraq. I think we're going to leave tons of thousands of private armies there.
Yeah.
Private armies, yeah.
Joe?
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't it be good to take this resolution to the occupation movement? It sounds like we all, most of us have them in our neighborhoods, and they need something like that. And going to the
Please.
City council with it is great. So isn't that
it.
One suggestion?
Go for it, Doctor.
Yes. Any
and
final?
And that's right on your, is that on the AFSC webpage, that resolution?
I talked with Mary Zirkle today, who is going to be putting it up, I trust, today. But you can just drop me an email, and I'll certainly get it to you.
Okay.
I just did. Thank you.
Okay.
You guys are good.
Maybe to all of us that are on this call.
Okay.
That'll be good.
Yeah, that's so good. I just want to thank everybody for joining the call. It was a great conversation, and I'm happy everybody felt comfortable jumping in and bringing their thoughts. I also want to allow you to kind of tell us how you saw tonight's call, how it felt to you. I'm looking forward to what we could do better, what you liked, and so you can email any of your comments to, again, AFSCNERO, NERO, all one word, at AFSC.org. If you have any comments or, you know, just thoughts of how we could do this better. This is our second time doing this, and so I just wanted to thank everybody for being on. I just want to remind also everybody that Thursday, just 2 days from now, we'll have Denise Altbader, our program coordinator for our Wabanaki program up in Maine. She will be doing the last of this series of phone conversations, and I invite all of you all, if you have time, to check in and hear and dialogue with Denise when you get a chance.
Please repeat that email address, because
sure.
I got it confused.
Yes, it's AFSCNERO.
At
AFSC.org.
I see why I was confused.
Okay.
And I'll just apologize for me speaking too fast, and I will agree that the U.S. is going to try to leave a number of contractors, some of whom are not particularly nice guys, in Iraq.
Maybe a few more things too.
Yeah.
Well,
bye.
Thank you, everybody. I really appreciate y'all being on, and take care. Have a good evening.
Thank you so much,
evening.
Joe.
Thank you, Joe.
Good night.
Thank you, Joe.
Bye.